expand and deliver effective presentations. And we're going to be joined by our presenter, Taylor Jones from CulturePoint. Taylor is a principal consultant there with CulturePoint and has experience as a facilitator and trainer, as well as a researcher. In addition to working in a consultative capacity with clients at DOD, Taylor is also a doctoral candidate in linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's presented papers to the Linguistics Society of America, the American Dialect Society, and a number of other organizations. And he has research that's been published in leading linguistics journals and has given talks as well at Stanford University, New York University, and a wealth of other institutions. So his approach and understanding of modeling language and changing and variation, social stratification in language, and his knowledge of topics in African-American English brings a really valuable perspective to the topic of diversity and inclusion in the workplace. So with that very brief introduction, let me turn it over to Taylor to get started.
Good afternoon, everybody. Normally I'd stop and wait for everybody to say good afternoon, but this is a slightly different format, so I'm just going to assume that you're all having a good afternoon or a good morning, depending on where you're listening from. So thank you for handing over to me. It looks like I actually have my technology running well, so this should be good. But basically, I want to lay a couple of ground rules, and then I'll introduce who I am, what I'm talking about, and all of that. For everybody here, if you have questions, please do not hesitate to share questions, comments, whatever you have in the Q&A box, and as we're going along, I'll pause for questions as well. If there are particularly urgent questions, I'm sure I can be interrupted to address those as well. So please, I want this to be as interactive as possible. I recognize that the medium makes it a little bit difficult to be as interactive as possible, as you know, it's not quite the same as if we were all in the same room. But that said, I really do value interaction here, so please don't hesitate with questions or comments or concerns or anything like that. Let's see if I can get my slides moving. All right. So our objectives today are threefold. They're to understand how people evaluate presentations, to review best practices for presentations, and to develop a game plan for presentations. So this is, in case you're in the wrong place or a little confused, this is going to be entirely about giving presentations that are public-facing. And my understanding is that all of you have some manner of presentations that you have to do, either with your colleagues or to the general public. And so this is really to get everybody with the best practices so that you have a game plan and can really go out there and give excellent presentations. Here we go. And I apologize for my brief hesitations at first. I'm, again, working through Adobe here. So our agenda is 4 points. An introduction, I'll go over an overview of the research. I'll talk about an overview of presentation skills and tools that you can use for really developing as a presenter. And then we'll talk about putting all of this together. So I think the first point that needs to be addressed is really who am I and why bother listening to what I have to say about presentations. So a little bit of that was touched on before, but there's a couple of different points that I think are all relevant to this particular topic. So first is that I'm a facilitator with a decade of experience teaching difficult topics around diversity and inclusion. What that means is I teach classes on race and ethnicity. I teach classes on unconscious bias. I teach classes on topics that are, in some ways, fundamentally uncomfortable or upsetting to people, and have to be able to get people through some of this difficult material without, ruining their day and everybody else's day and having a contentious discussion and all of that. So I recognize that all of you have slightly different talks that you'll be giving. However, with NARPM, with OSC, with a lot of the work that you're all doing, it's still in some ways very contentious and emotional for some audience members. So this is something where I think my background here is very, very useful to you, even though it's a slightly different twist. And with that consulting work, I've been doing that for over a decade. I work, as was mentioned, with the Department of Defense. I teach a regular class at the Naval Postgraduate School. I just spoke with a colleague of mine to the judges of the Navy Marine Corps Trial Judiciary. So these are, serious people, sometimes very opinionated audiences will say, and it's something that the tools that I'm going to discuss a little bit later are tools that help in those contexts. The second is that I'm a quantitative social scientist, and I have teaching experience across a variety of classes, everything from introduction to sociolinguistics and introduction to linguistics to languages of Africa and structure of Zulu. So a wide variety of things in the academic domain, and tons and tons and tons of conference talks, invited lectures, academic talks for the general public. So there's a range there between teaching undergraduates, teaching graduate students, and then also talking to, you know, interested laymen and members of the general public. I gave two talks actually earlier this week at Yale, and I'll be going out to the University of California, Irvine next week, or I think the week after, to talk at a project that's called American Monuments, which is just for the general public. So it's a really broad range of audiences, and I'm communicating scientific ideas to people depending on whatever their level is. And I think that's an important thing that we'll talk about a little bit later, is figuring out what the level of your audience is. And lastly, while this might not seem at first as relevant, I'm a performer with a background of playing music professionally. So before graduate school, I spent almost a decade playing jazz in New York, and that's a lesson in leadership, but also a lesson in really interacting with people and managing a room, because you will get aggressive feedback very quickly if you are not managing the room appropriately. So what ties those all together is that my career consists of communicating scientific ideas to the general public through presentations, and that's relying on the platform skills that we're going to discuss shortly. Are there questions about that before I continue? I expect not, but I always like to pause and make sure that we're all on the same page.
No official questions on the topic, but okay. Somebody was a little bit interested on what African-American English is.
Ooh, okay. What I will do, because that's in part my academic expertise and in part, you know, what my dissertation is on, it's very easy for me to get sidetracked when you ask me about that. So what I will do is say that people can email me and follow up, or they can go to my academic website, which is languagejones.com, and have an explainer there of what African-American vernacular English is, what African-American English is, all of that stuff. And I'll probably touch on that a little bit later, because it will be relevant to our discussion of presentations and you know, managing perceptions of your own background. But I have primers there for people on their own time as well. And thank you for bringing that up. So I'm going to quickly move into just an overview of the research. I hope that's a sufficient answer. I really I could talk all day about that, so I want to not get myself sidetracked. I know myself here. So the overview of the research, I think the first question that's the most important question that we have is, why bother? And the argument that I'm going to present is that there's a wealth of research that indicates that platform skills affect perceived credibility. So your platform skills, your lack thereof, are going to affect the extent to which people believe what it is you have to tell them, and the extent to which people are willing to you know, cooperate with you and with what you have to tell them. For all of you, you're public-facing, and your work is important, so it's important that it's communicated effectively. This is, you know, an organization where the work that you do, OSC, NARPM folks, this affects people in their day-to-day lives, and it's very, very important work. It's not just, you know, here's some fun facts. Usually the facts are, I guess, not as fun for people. But the idea here is that, you know, it's really quite important what you have to tell people. And so you want to make sure that you're understood and that you're understood and believed, really. So the last part, and this is, I think, the most important part, is that platform skills are skills. They're not inherent. You can learn, you can practice, you can improve. So if you are not great at presentations, I would tell you that nobody is when they first start. Maybe there's some, you know, extra talented, gifted person out there. But in general, we all have to start from somewhere, and you learn these skills. I just have a head start on developing these skills because it's been more or less my career for the past, you know, decade plus. So let's get into the research. The first part is that we can tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it. And that's a lot of this research is, I think, starts from a place where we're asking, you know, what do we know and how do we know it? And so a lot of this stuff may sound very simple. You know, we can tell when people believe what they're saying. But there's different cues that affect how we tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it. So there are verbal and nonverbal cues. There's sounds of confidence and doubt in the voice. And then there's just pitch range as well. When we talk about verbal versus nonverbal cues, if there's a mismatch between what you're saying and your body language as you're saying it or how you're saying it, people will notice that. And they'll start to try and figure out, well, why is there this mismatch? Is this person being dishonest with me? Does this person not believe what they're saying? So if you have a very, you know, confident script, for instance, but you are delivering it with body language that betrays that you are not confident in what you were saying, people start to question that. And there's a fair amount of research on this. Kenny et al. 2019 is a very good example. I'm not expecting everybody to go out and track down these studies. There won't be a quiz on this later, but I do like to have some of these references in here just for completeness sake. The second is that sounds of confidence and doubt. So one of the things that I do in my research is acoustic phonetics, which is literally looking at how people sound, like how we produce sounds physically from, you know, expelling air from the lungs, causing the vocal cords to vibrate, how you use your mouth, all of that in producing sounds. And one of the things that phoneticians can do is look at different cues as to how people react to sounds as well. So when we're looking at sounds of confidence and doubt, there's two elements that really affect how people feel about what they're hearing. And those, the technical terms are actually jitter and shimmer, but generally I think it's easier to think of this as breathlessness, right? So if you're not very confident in what you're saying, one cue for that would be sort of out of breath, you know, shimmer to your voice. Another is vocal pitch, and that means not just how high your voice is, although that is a specific cue, but also, and I mean how high within your own register. So if you have a naturally high voice, by the way, that's not, you know, people won't suddenly not trust you. They just know that that's your voice. But within your own register, how high it is, and whether you're using declarative statements or whether you have a sort of questioning rise in your voice is going to affect the way that people perceive what you're saying. Specifically talking about vocal frequency, this last study that I have in citation here is, I think, particularly interesting because what they did is they got people who were experts in a field, and they weren't really interested in the thing that these people were experts in. They were interested in how they talk when they're not, when they're talking about things they're experts in versus when they're talking about things they don't know. And so what they did is they had a researcher come into the room where they had these people waiting. And they would ask them a question like, where's the bathroom in this building? But this is a building that they weren't familiar with. And then they would later ask them about their own research and whatever else. And they found that when they're talking about their own research, where they are experts, they had a lower pitch, lower vocal frequency when they were giving expert advice versus when they were asked where the bathroom is and they didn't know, they would be unsure and they would communicate that verbally. So it would be like, well, I think it's down the hall. I think it's over here. So these are things that people notice immediately. And of course they notice them immediately in part because we intentionally and unintentionally use them in a communicative fashion, right? So you know as soon as you ask me where's the bathroom, I go, well, I think, not just from the words, but also from my voice, that I'm not as sure in what I'm saying. So all of this may sound like, you know, you may wonder, well, why did we have to do this research to find this out? But we get very specific information about what exactly it is that people are attending to when they're listening to speakers. So same thing, these clues to confidence are measurable. Pitch, I just touched on. Intonation, that's the rise and fall. And speed, influence perceptions of speaker confidence. So in this study in particular, they were looking at confidence versus lack of confidence. One of the things that people tend to do is speak faster when they're not confident in what they're saying. Now, this is not universal, so there's definitely regional and ethnic and other factors that affect how quickly you speak. I'm calling in from Manhattan, and I will tell you that my main cue for myself in giving presentations is to slow down and to enunciate because I am used to speaking very, very fast, not because I'm not sure of what I'm saying, but it's just sort of a cultural thing of where I am and who I'm usually speaking with. These are not universal. And so as you're giving a presentation, while it may be a little bit more artificial, and we'll talk about this later, it's helpful to have a specific set couple of cues for how you speak when you're talking to groups of people versus just casual interactions with other people. The second part that I have on here is that we're more likely to believe and to cooperate with people who send signals of confidence. And what's really interesting about that is it's even when we later think it wasn't about presentation skills. So this study by Clark in 2008 was looking at presentation skills. They gave something like, they gave, you know, the same presentation in different ways, and they asked people to evaluate these presentations, and on average they found that the people who used some of the tools that we'll talk about a little bit later in this session were perceived as more confident and having given a better presentation, even though the actual presentation itself was the same. So it's not just the material that you're communicating. You can have a good presentation and good slides, but if you don't present it well, people may begin to question it more than they really otherwise should, given the quality of your work. So this is not really bad news. This is just information that we can leverage later. The next bit, which is the important part that I'm trying to get to, is not only can we measure this, we can improve it with training. And this is verified in the literature. So this is not my, you know, high hopes, pie in the sky, very optimistic thinking where I say, well, you know, yes, we can tell when people are uncomfortable, and some of us are uncomfortable giving presentations, but, you know, boy, you can really turn that around. This is validated by the empirical literature. So communication training improves presentation skills, and that's been found over and over again. The other thing is practice, of course. So as you have these skills, as you develop these skills, you get better and better at giving presentations. You may have an off day every now and then, but this is something that the research is very clear. It's not inherent. It's not inborn. It's something that you can develop and you can train. So the takeaway here is that presentation skills matter. We've established that they affect believability, audience confidence, all of this stuff. So it's not just what you're saying. It's how you're saying it. And the better your presentation skills are, the easier your presentations will go. So that's important. Presentation skills matter. We can improve communication skills with training and practice. And I think for all of you, like I said, you have a very important message. You're public facing, and you have important things you have to tell people. So it would behoove us all to develop our presentation skills so that we can actually communicate those things effectively to the audience. What questions do you have before I move on to an overview of those presentation skills?
So we had a couple of questions come in, and one of the participants asked if you could comment on voice inflection at the end of phrases and how this affects credibility. They're specifically thinking about how this is commonly used by millennials.
Yes, I can comment a lot on that. I will leave some of that for later in the presentation, but what I will say now is that it sounds like there's two separate aspects of vocal inflection that are used, used by everyone, but that are perceived to be used more by millennials, by Generation Z. It really depends on who we're talking about when we talk about millennials. Some millennials are in their 40s now, and by generally by young women. And the perception is that these are used more, and they're vocal fry, which is not really the technical term. It's actually, weirdly, the technical term is creaky voice, which doesn't sound more technical, but there is a difference. And high-rising terminal, which is colloquially referred to as uptalk. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later in the session, but both of those are socially evaluated. Both of those happen naturally. They happen across a variety of languages. Some of them are meaningful differences in languages. So, for instance, in, you know, Vietnamese, for instance, creaky voice is a way of telling apart different sounds. And if you don't have creaky voice, you're not saying the word right. But in English, they're a little bit more marked because they're not used in that way. And they're associated with social things about the people speaking. That is not to say that they're necessarily correctly associated in that way. So, one of the people who uses the most creaky voice that I've ever heard in my life is Noam Chomsky, but he's never criticized for creaky voice because it's not really socially evaluated, especially among older people, especially among white people and especially among men. So if you're an older white guy, creaky voice, you can get away with. and you may have noticed that today, just from my from cold and from coffee and everything else, I have a little bit of creak in my voice. What I will say is that it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, people are socially evaluated for it, and as a linguist, I would tell you that those social evaluations are not grounded in anything inherent or linguistic. They're social evaluations about the people. On the other hand, if we're talking about effective performance and effective presentations, they may be worth thinking about and preparing for how your audience will receive you. So I don't want to tell anybody that how they speak is wrong, because the scientific literature, the consensus is that it's not. But what I will say is, if you know that you're going into a room full of people who think that it's wrong, it may be a good strategy to be able to adapt to your audience. I hope that answers that question. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, because voice and voice quality, managing your voice, is going to be something that we talk about a fair amount with the presentation skills. Normally here I would ask, did that answer your question? But I think it's a little harder with this format. So I'm going to hope that it did, and if it didn't, please ask more in just a minute. So that said, I'm going to get into the overview of presentation skills. is everybody on the presentation competency slide now? Can you verify that for me?
Yes, we are.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. We'll talk about managing technology as well in a minute. So for the presentation competencies, I would say you can divide things into four broad classes. The first is content management, then visual aids, platform skills, and participant management. And there's a lot of different ways that you can approach all of these. So I'll give you what I think are best practices, but you can adapt these to whatever your audience is and whatever your situation is. So a lot of this is going to be sort of broad strokes. This is tools that you can use to really think about how to tailor your particular presentation to whatever the audience is going to be for this week. Like I said, I gave two, high-level academic talks at an Ivy League institution earlier this week, and I'm going and talking to the general public in Southern California about, police shootings and all this other stuff next week, and it's radically different kinds of presentations, but the skill sets and the tools that I'm drawing from for both of these presentations are the same set of skills. So for content management, effective speakers will connect subject matter with the objectives. And you'll notice I started today with what are our objectives for the course. They're to understand how presentations are evaluated, they're to have a set of tools to develop your presentations, and to be able to get you out of here with more skills and something to practice that you can use and have a game plan for your presentations moving forward. So immediately from jump, I had these are the objectives, and this is how my presentation is connected to that. You'll analyze participants' needs, current level of expertise and expectations, identify and organize key points that support the objectives and meet their needs, and then identify potential problem areas and strategies for how you deal with those problem areas. So when we talk about analyzing participants' needs and current level of expertise and expectations, this is a lot of the work, really. It's not just putting together your slides. It's not just having the information, but it's figuring out who you're communicating that information to and how they can best receive that information. So for a lot of you, you're going back and forth between giving presentations to coworkers and colleagues who understand all of the background that you understand as well and who speak the same language. And by the same language, I mean like technical jargon that you know. And you're going back and forth between that and then speaking with the general public who maybe, depending on who you're talking to, they don't have the entry-level background information to understand some of the things that you want to tell them. So analyzing participants' needs and current level of expertise is hugely important, because if you're giving that jargony, highly detailed talk, but you're giving it to an audience that doesn't understand what you're saying, it's not going to go well. Best case scenario, they're very quiet and then they leave. But in general, that kind of thing doesn't really leave the audience with a great feeling. So you want to start from, who am I talking to, really? And then get an idea of, like, put yourself in their shoes and say, what do they reasonably know? And what will I need to explain? Then you're going to want to identify and organize the key points that support the objectives and meet their needs. And this is tricky as well, because a lot of us get really into the weeds about wanting to explain everything. And for all of you, for the presentations that you're giving, once you've identified your objectives, once you've identified their needs, you can start to trim away material that's not as important, that, you know, may be interesting to you or may be relevant, but doesn't necessarily lead your participants where you need them to go in the quickest and easiest and most understandable fashion. And so those are the kind of things that I like to put in backup slides, for instance, or just be able to answer separately. But it really, really helps to streamline a presentation, say what really is the bare minimum that I need to communicate the important points for my objective here. And then the last part is to identify potential problem areas and strategies. So if you have an idea of where things can go wrong, where things can go off the rails, where people can misunderstand, then you can start to brainstorm how to address those. So when it happens, you're prepared. This is, you know, not just improvise, adapt, overcome, but this is, you have a plan. You hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And for presentations, usually the worst is just somebody doesn't understand. So when you're talking about content management, the key focus here is, what is the key point of your talk? Then you want to say, what do people need to know to understand that point? And what's, like I said, the minimum that they need to know to understand that point? And then where can they go astray? And that's where you kind of fill in a little bit more after that. So you want to make sure that people understand those key points. So for a lot of you, the key point of the talk is going to be something fairly straightforward. You're not necessarily explaining some complicated technical thing to folks. It's usually, you know, here is a problem, more often than not, and it is located here. Here's what you need to understand about the problem, and here's the plan, and here's what's needed of you, or here's what's expected of us. So that should be fairly straightforward, but then you have this question of where can they go astray? What points that you say, if you don't explain it clearly, will they fixate on and maybe not understand? And if you brainstorm those in advance, then you can sort of hold people's hands and guide them through these troubled waters in your presentation. I know I'm mixing metaphors there, but bear with me. And then, you know, they'll follow along and understand it. It'll go much, much smoother. So when we're talking about content management, let's dig into this a little bit more. The basic organization will be introducing the topic, providing a motivation, describing the necessary context, then you explain the research question or point you want to make, whatever it is, and lay out the data and analysis and strategy. So you'll notice, what did I do today? I started with the topic, then I provided a motivation, right? I gave my introduction and who I am and all that, but then a motivation of presentation skills matter. And here's how we know that, and here's why this is important to you. Then you describe the necessary context, if people need background information to understand what you're going to say. And then explain the research question or point you want to make. So that's the bulk of the presentation. That's that middle section there. And lay out your data, your analysis strategy. Again, it doesn't have to be everything. And in fact, it's generally best practice to have, you know, the most streamlined possible story that you can tell. And then you can fill in more information later. I know the military in particular loves what they call bluff, which is bottom line up front. And they say, we'll just backfill from there. So as much as I find the sort of corporate and military jargon of backfill, you know, mildly annoying. It's something that is actually a really effective technique and very helpful for giving presentations. Now, continuing that, you want to talk about documenting the findings, and there's a bunch of different ways that you can do this. And then you can provide comments to explain your findings, the implications of your argument, whatever it is, and then wrap up. So when you're documenting things, there's a variety of ways you can do this. It can be point by point, or it can be laying out the necessary pieces to make your argument, and like I said, jettisoning some extra stuff that you can address if people ask about it, but doesn't necessarily help you with your streamlined argument. The last two, I think, are really hugely important, and they're things that we don't really do as well. This takes more training. So providing comments to explain findings or the implications of the argument and the wrap-up, those are things that we kind of sleep on a little bit. When you provide the comments to explain your findings or the implications, what that does is that helps people understand why you were telling them that in the first place. A lot of times it's very easy for us to give information to people and then hope that they, or even expect that they, make the right assumptions or draw the right conclusions based on the information that we've given them. So we hope that it's enough to just show them the information and they get the point and do the right thing. And what I'm here to tell you is that that is not very common. So one of the things that I highly, highly recommend is for any talk, make it as clear as possible, do as much signposting as possible, and once you've explained something, really go back and explain why you explained it, because there's always going to be somebody who needs that help. So there's going to be somebody who maybe doesn't get it the first time, but when you explain why I just showed you this, they say, oh, I get it now. And you never know if somebody got a phone call, got lost in their thoughts, you know, looked out the window, whatever it is. You want to give as much signposting as possible so that people can actually follow along. And if they do get lost or they do get distracted, they can come back and know where they are. And the last part is that wrap-up. This is, again, hugely important and something that people kind of forget to do. So it's, you know, I give you a whole two-hour presentation on presentations and then say, okay, thanks, bye. It's not the same as if I give you this two-hour talk and then summarize everything that we talked about and tie a nice bow on it and have something that you remember at the very end. Oh, yes, this is what we did. This is the key takeaway. This is, you know, the point of this conversation. And especially the longer the talk that you give, the more important this becomes. So for, you know, a 20-minute conference talk, I might have a one-sentence wrap-up or a two-sentence wrap-up. For a two-hour session, it may be a little bit more than that. For a day or a week, you know, I may spend a half hour, an hour on this is what we covered, this is why we did it, this is how we got there, and making sure that we're all on the same page so that when people leave your presentation, they're leaving, if not happy, at least they understand what it was that they heard, understand what it was they went through, understand why they did that, and they walk away with something sort of better off than they were before. So I hope that makes sense to everybody. You can tell at this point probably that I'm used to and encourage audience participation. There's different expectations around that, but I'm fighting the urge here to ask, like, does that make sense to everybody? And since I'm, you know, talking into the phone and there's, I hear 179 people out there listening on mute, it's a different experience. And what I will say is that as you go through this, you know, different presentations are going to be very different depending on what the audience is and who you're interacting with. But the presentation skills here, again, that we're talking about are going to be a through line for all of those. So that's something I think it's important to keep in mind. It's just all of these work really no matter what the situation is. But some situations are going to be very different than others. So, you know, if I tell you solicit audience participation, that's going to be up to you to what extent you enjoy that, to what extent you feel comfortable with that, to what extent you want to have people hold questions till the end or have them in the middle. But then you will also have to adapt to whatever the exigencies of the situation are. Now, what questions do you have before we move on to visual aids about organization and content management?
So I'll give the audience here a moment just to see if they have any questions. I didn't see any come in there earlier, but some people have been LOLing along with you. So they've been laughing and agreeing
with
you.
That's reassuring.
So they are there. We did have a question that came in earlier about how to address a situation where management might want you to communicate information in one way and that doesn't necessarily align with how you personally feel about it, which could influence your confidence when up there talking. And I'm not sure if we should pause now or wait.
So I like that question. Is it possible, is there more elaboration on that, or that's the whole question?
Well,
I can give a more specific answer, but I need more specific information.
The wording here that they don't feel grounded in what they're being told to say, management wants information to be said in a certain way, and it's different than how we personally feel. I could give you an example where I've encountered something like this where we might get new tools in our workplace to use, and we need to teach people how to use these tools, and maybe there are some problems with these tools, but the people who are rolling it out don't want me to highlight those problems. They just want me to talk about how great they are. So I might be aware of the problem, but I'm kind of being told, don't talk about those. We want them to start using them, not point out why they won't want to use them. It might not be what they were talking about, but I've certainly been in that scenario where I'm asked to highlight certain things, but not perhaps other things that I would want to mention if I could.
Sure. Okay, so I think there's two different ways that I could answer that. So one is depending on what the information is, really. So if it's, you know, some area of expertise or some new finding or whatever it is that you have to communicate. And management wants you to communicate it in a particular way. One of the things that I've found is it is fine to give the standard line and to translate that for people. And I think audiences generally respect that and appreciate that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes, actually. But if it's, you know, it's one kind of information, you have to communicate it this way. You do have to sort of balance meeting your audience where they are. So if they're not going to understand what you're saying, then sure, say it the official way, but then get everybody on board so they understand what that is. The second that you mentioned, which is, you know, there's a new tool that's rolling out and there's, we'll say, known issues or you know, known bugs or whatever it is, then that's a little bit different because your consideration there is the organization and the organizational mission, and to what extent does highlighting these help or hinder the organization and their mission, and to what extent is it necessary? So it's a tightrope there, but if you can walk that tightrope where you follow the company line, right, about what it is that is being rolled out, but then, you know, when people on their own bring up these other aspects, you can be sort of down to earth with them about it. I think that's usually the best possible practice. You know, we have a realistic understanding of what's happening here, but the company line is this, and, you know, let's get on board. Now, if it's something where you have to pass feedback up the chain, then, you know, it really depends on whether it's just a minor annoyance or whether it's going to, like, you know, sink ships. So I mentioned I do a lot of work with the Navy. Like, if planes are going to fall out of the sky, then you have to say something. But if it's just there's some minor annoyances here, you know, then it's you know, incumbent on us to go with the organization and the mission and to, I guess, I hate to say this, but depending on what it is, just to suck it up and then work with, you know, fixing bugs as we move forward.
Okay.
I hope that's a sufficient answer for now. And was there any more in content management?
No, we are getting questions though about PowerPoint or visual aids as well as.
Oh, we're coming in. All right, so that is those are next. We'll keep it moving. So, let's talk about visual aids. So, effective speakers prepare visuals that are legible or readable, clearly related to the content being presented, organized and consistently formatted. And all of these will probably sound very basic when I say them, but you would be surprised at how many of us have difficulty really following all of these guidelines at the same time. So legible and readable, I will tell you, working with academics and academic linguists, it is absolutely wild how often people do not put legible, readable slides. I saw a plenary address this year at the Linguistic Society of America, and I won't tell you which one it was, but what I will tell you is that this linguist had basically written a very long paper and then put paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs on their slides. So nobody could read it. Even if you could read it, it was, you know, full sentences, long sentences. Half of them were in Greek, literally. So it was just a really brutal, brutal slideshow. And, you know, it depends on who you are and what your background is, but some of us fall into this trap more than others, especially the academics love having, you know, slides that are actually papers and not really slides. So having something legible and readable with the, you know, the minimum amount that you can have on the slide that is communicating your point but and still readable is hugely, hugely important, because one of the easiest ways to lose an audience and have them check out is to put a wall of text in front of them that they are feel like they're expected to read. The second is clearly related to content being presented. I'm going to continue to pick on linguists and tell you about a colleague of mine who gave a talk in 2015, and I honestly don't remember the subject of the talk. It was something to do with phonology, which is, you know, how sounds of a language work and how they're processed in the mind. But I don't know anybody who remembers the content of this talk. What we remember is that every single slide had cat memes from the internet. And this was something that definitely got people's attention, but was not an effective way of communicating this material, because this person has become the cat meme linguist. And everybody says, oh, that was the person who did that slideshow with all the cat memes. But they're not known for their work, and I couldn't tell you honestly what it was that they were talking about in that presentation a few years ago. So, you know, that's an extreme example, obviously, but the content really should be clearly directly related to the material being presented. And that's not to say that you can't have, you know, fun and funny stuff in your slides, but I would say it's something that you want to, you know, assess who the audience is, first of all, and then still maybe use sparingly. So it can go well, but, you know, if you have a half-hour talk and every slide is cats from the internet, then that's what people are going to remember. The next two, a little bit more straightforward, organized and consistently formatted. So you'll notice all of my slides for this are following a very specific format, and they're consistently formatted. This is something that it takes very, very little time to go through and double-check everything, but it makes a huge difference, because as soon as you're giving a presentation, you wouldn't think that people would care, but people really, really do notice and really, really do care if there's extra spaces and some fonts are serif and some fonts are not, and you're alternating between, you know, Times New Roman and Comic Sans and Papyrus and whatever else across your slides, and all the sizes are all different. It's weirdly extremely distracting for the audience, even though, you know, the content's the same, the slide's a slide, but it really has an effect. So I would say it takes 5 minutes to go through a slideshow. This is a two-hour slideshow. It took 5 minutes to go through and just double-check that everything's in the same font, that I don't have extra paragraph spaces or whatever else going around. Now, mark my words, as soon as I say that I've double-checked all this, we are going to find a stray comma somewhere or period or something. But in general, that's the hope, that it's minimized and that you have maybe one thing wrong and it's not just all over the place with different fonts and different sizes and cat memes and whatever else. So I think that's the core points there. What I'll say, too, is that you have to then manage your visual aids, and that means testing equipment, having contingency plans. I'm using my current contingency plan right now, so I can't actually see that I'm pulling my slides step by step, so I have my contingency plan where I can manage that I can see my slides with plan B here. And then you want to position your body to avoid blocking participants' view. That's, you'll notice, very easy for me today, but in general, that's something to think about. And then speak to participants rather than the visual. So when you're testing the equipment, that in part can mean showing up early. That in part can mean having your own equipment. Like I said, I do work with the military, and they consistently invite me to bring my own laptop on base, and I have to remind them that if I do that, I can't take it off base. You know, you're not allowed to bring thumb drives. Knowing who your client is and what is and isn't available to you is hugely important, so you don't show up somewhere and expect, okay, for instance, I have my slides on a thumb drive, and, you know, find out, well, you're not allowed to bring that here. So planning that out, testing your equipment beforehand, having backup plans, that's important. Now, in some instances, you don't always get to choose. You don't always get to have the backup plan that you might want. So maybe you can print out handouts for people. Maybe you don't have that as an option. But in general, if you know what your options are beforehand, it makes everything go a lot smoother day of. As you're talking, you want to position your body to avoid blocking the participant's view. I know we've all had that experience of standing in front of a slide projector and blinding ourselves. So that's exactly where you don't want to stand. But what I will say is that depending on the room, depending on the format, you may find it easier or harder to stand out of the way. But as people are reading your slides, if you have a visual aid, you want people to be able to see it. So if it's whiteboards, for instance, you want them to be positioned in the room where people can read them. They don't have to turn around and face the other direction. If it's slides, you want to make sure that you're standing to the side of them, preferably close by, especially if you want to point out anything on your slides. But in general, you want to be standing beside them so people can see them and read them, and you're not blocking people's view. And that means doing a little bit of spatial reasoning as well, because you could be standing, you know, not directly in front of your slides, but still blocking half the audience's view depending on the layout of the room. So in that case, you want to think about what your options are, where you can stand So you're not blocking people's view. And if there's not one place that you can stand, then you want to start, you know, moving a little bit to make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to see what they need to see. Lastly here, you want to speak to participants rather than the visual. So this is extremely common, especially when you get those long, long, long slideshows where people have put their whole, you know, essay in the slides. The most common thing when you see that is that they then turn around and read it at you. You'll notice that I have been reading some of these points to you, but I'm using them as a starting point for discussion to explain what I'm talking about rather than just reading my bullet points to you. If I was just going to read bullet points to you, we could just send you the slides and you can read them on your own time and probably do it a lot faster. So the idea here is that you want to speak to the audience and speak about what your presentation is on rather than just reading your slides and facing away from them. Nobody really wants to look at somebody's back and watch them read aloud. Well, I assume most people don't. So we're going to talk about what makes a slide bad. And I think the best way to do this is to look at some examples of bad slides. If you've already seen a version of this presentation, then these will be familiar to you. But what I want to do is open this up for people to add their voices and say, what makes these slides coming up bad? Oh, it just moved. Okay. Let's see. There we go. So, this is a bad slide. How rivers are formed. I see on here too many words. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm seeing responses. Okay. Too much text, too many words. So we've got that. Yeah, I see too much text and white font on a colorful background. It's hard to read. I see font color is hard to read. It's also a serif font. It's a small font. So you have a lot of things contributing to our inability to really easily read what this slide is about. You have white font on a yellow background, right, or a light blue background, or in some places white font on a white background, which is not an easy thing for your audience. These graphics don't show how rivers are formed. It's actually, I like that. That's the first time that somebody has pointed that out. It's just a picture of a river. Yeah. So it's hard
we
to read.
Got a chat that is missing a cat meme.
Right. Where's the cats? does not take into account, you know, how cats are related. Yeah. So there's a couple of points I would draw your attention to. One is this does follow some best practices, right? There's six bullet points here. It's not overcrowding everything. But each of those bullet points is long, full sentences. And this is not even just full sentences, but they're using modifiers here that are unnecessary. So, you know, start very small streams, gradually get bigger as more and more water. You don't need all that. It's also, as we mentioned, a light font on a light background. It's a small font. It is a small font that's a serif font. It's just all of this is very, very... is contributing to the difficulty in reading this. But it's also telling everything they want to say rather than just key points that they can then speak to and expound upon. Now, what I will also say is you'll notice that there were standards for how we do slides for this presentation, and I have fit my bad slide as an image into the good slide best practice, right? So I have my title, a bad slide, I have one image, I have my footer that's, you know, 2020 OSC Academy and my number of my slide. So even in showing you a bad slide, in this slideshow, I'm doing that within the frame of following best practices for a good slide. So let's do one more. This is one of my favorite categories of slides. This is slides from the Pentagon. And I highly recommend, if you haven't already, to go online and Google Pentagon slides. Or Pentagon bad slides, because they are notorious for too much clip art and all sorts of ridiculous stuff. So what do we have here? I see hurts me to read. I apologize for those of you who are now experiencing headaches. Yeah, it looks like a government job, absolutely. Too many lines to follow. What they've done here, to my understanding, is try to explain the entirety of the Iraq war, if I remember correctly. So it's just way too much stuff going on here. And they try to fit everything into a slide. This should be an hour-long presentation at a minimum. And instead, it is one slide with arrows going from everything to everything else. And so nothing really draws your attention. Nothing seems to matter. There's no clear organization. You don't know where to start, where to end. It's just this mess. And I don't think this was an intentional metaphor for a military quagmire. I think this was just somebody put this slide together and they thought, this is going to be comprehensive. They're going to love this. So it's way too much stuff. Very, very confusing. Too many lines to follow. So this is, I'll navigate away from this so we don't have to suffer anymore, but that is another example of a bad slide. So when we talk about slides, then you want to have your slides be good slides. We'll talk about that a little bit more. I think I have another slide after this on exactly how to format them. But the key points that I'll preview right now are you want to use bullet points. Use no more than like 6, 7. You know, if you have 12 bullet points in a slide, it starts getting to be something where you should probably break it up. Beyond that, writing in full sentences is not really something that you have to avoid, but I would say try and keep them short, declarative, and clear, and make it something that you can expand upon later rather than trying to tell everybody everything in the slide. As you're writing your slides, this should be mnemonics for you to be able to talk to your audience rather than all of the information that they need in a more boring form. So that's a quick high-level overview. What I'll say with regards to other technology as well is that this is really important and this plays in with your slides. So slides are one thing. We usually think about the slides. We prepare for it. We send them off when we need to have them sent off, and we expect that that's going to work. But the slides are only one part of the technology that may be relevant to you giving a presentation. So I will say one is arrive early. Find your point of contact for tech, if any. Sometimes you don't have one and you're on your own. And increasingly I'm getting, you know, good at making my VGA and HDMI and, you know, all sorts of connections as necessary. But you want to arrive early, find your point of contact, hope that you have one. And if you don't have one because you arrived early, you can figure stuff out. You buy yourself some time. Or if you do have one, you buy yourself some time when they say, well, I got to go here and get this and I got to go there and get that. Always it's helpful to, you know, think about when your talk is and then be there well in advance. So for talking at 1 o'clock Eastern time today, I was here before noon. And everything went fine, so I'm just sitting here, you know, waiting and twiddling my thumbs and thinking thoughts, but that's the ideal, that you have a little bit of time to decompress before giving your presentation where you can get in the right headspace. And if not, if something does go wrong, you have the time to troubleshoot and to address it before your talk so that you're on time, you don't keep people waiting, and you can keep everything running smoothly. I'll say test the microphone setup if it's present. So, you know, usually if there's a tech person, they'll help you out with a lapel mic or with a handheld or whatever it is they have. And then regardless of what it is, I'll say if it is present, use it. Don't assume everybody can hear you. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen presentations where people say, well, I'll just speak loudly. Can you hear me in the back? Like, that's the most common one. Can everybody in the back hear me? And when nobody in the back responds, maybe because they couldn't hear you, they say, okay, looks like they can. I'm just going to talk however, you know, however loudly I can. Always, 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 if a microphone is present, use it. And I'll tell you, there's a couple of reasons why. One is that it simplifies everything. Two is that you never know what people's disabilities are. So you never know if there are people who are reliant on the microphone. So, for instance, again, you know, with the Navy, with a lot of military clients, there are people who have specific hearing loss. There's targeted disabilities in the Navy. Hearing loss is one of them. And that's to be expected from things like, you know, working in an engine room or firing a gun or being near artillery or whatever. So people, you know, may have maybe hard of hearing in one ear or both. And so as you're talking to people like this, if you assume that everybody can hear you, they may not tell you, I have hearing loss in one ear, and may try and, you know, read lips, read slides, and figure it out. But then you're not being as effective for your audience. The other thing is there may be people who have some hearing implants, for instance, that are directly tied to a PA system. So I was at a linguistics conference recently where there's a fantastic film. So I'm going to go on a little bit of a diversion here, or a little bit of a tangent here. Digression, not diversion. There we go. I'm a linguist. I know my words. Here we go. So I'm going on a slight digression. There's a fantastic film called Talking Black in America. It just won an Emmy. It's a documentary about African-American English. I highly recommend it. After it was made, they made a partner film called Signing Black in America, which is specifically about African-American and black sign language, which for a variety of historical reasons is different than American Sign Language, like white American Sign Language, and different from other kinds of sign languages, British Sign Language, French Sign Language, et cetera, et cetera. I was at a screening for this film where it was a lot of linguists. It was a lot of people who were deaf, who were either born deaf, who had hearing loss, but in general there were people who could not hear, and a handful of people who had in-ear implants or other, you know, implants that were associated with or directly tied to the PA system in the room. And I watched people say, I'm not going to take the microphone because I don't like how my voice sounds. I'm just going to talk louder. In a room where there were people who were completely deaf, or a room where there were people who were, you know, expecting to, you know, have the audio come through in part because it's directly tied into the PA system, or the tech system that they had there. So it's an extreme example, but the key point here is that you don't know what other people's experience is, and for a variety of reasons. In this case, you know, the sign language interpreters couldn't hear what the person was saying. But whatever the reason is, you don't necessarily know what other people's situation is, and the technology will help them. Now, the last thing that I'll say about this is that I completely understand when people say, well, I don't like the sound of my voice. That is normal, that is natural, that is extremely common, and there's a scientific reason for it as well. So we actually are used to hearing our own voices in a particular way, which is to say, as we're speaking, we hear our own voice as we're talking, and we hear it in part from, you know, the sound of the room bouncing back towards us, but we also in part hear it from vibrating, you know, from our skull. Vibrating from our jaw, you know, everything that's resonant as we're speaking in our bodies is, you know, vibrating as well with that speech. When you hear yourself recorded, when you hear yourself played back to you, played back to yourself from a microphone, what you're hearing is the same voice, but without that vibration in your skull and your neck and all of that. And so what happens is it sounds different and it sounds uncanny. And I'm sure everybody's heard people say, like, do I really sound like that? So it's something that is completely normal and natural to maybe not like how you sound when you're not hearing it from your own voice speaking in the moment. But it's something that hopefully understanding why there is that effect will help you, basically, I will say will help you get over it and allow you to be comfortable using the microphone. And the last thing is, if it's a handheld mic, it gives you something to do with your hands. So I know I've gone on for a little bit about this. I'm sort of a microphone evangelist. If it exists, use it. I understand there are other reasons why people may dislike using the microphones, but best practice, if it's there, test it out and use it. All right, so for other technology, I'm going to move on because I've sort of harped on microphones for a long time now. Other technology, make sure, like I said, this is the same thing. I'm sorry. What slide are you all seeing? Basics of platform skills? Yes?
That's correct.
Good. Okay. Good. So for the platform skills, well, first of all, are there other questions about visuals or about the technology before I continue?
We actually had a question about fonts. Someone noted that they have been told that they should be using a sans serif font, and they wanted to know if you thought that was correct.
I generally agree with that. It really depends on the situation, but in general, I think a sans serif font is easier to read. There's some research on this as well, and the people make the claim that it's a little bit easier to read. There are people who would suggest that you should use, you know, a 20-point Comic Sans font because it's the easiest for people to read. And I think unless you have a very compelling reason to do that, I would recommend against it. But there are Comic Sans evangelists out there who really, you know, say it needs to be big and it needs to be in that font because it's specifically designed for readability. Problem is that font is also somewhat stigmatized as being, you know, juvenile. So anything like a Cambria, a Helvetica, I'm not a huge font expert here, but anything that's a sans serif font is usually considered a little bit easier to read for people. Were there
Okay,
others?
and you just hit some of the other questions that we had about Comic Sans and whether or not to
Did
use it. So
I?
you did. You did.
I mean,
So I think.
if it's for reasons of inclusion, if there are people who you know are going to be in the audience who would be better served by a Comic Sans font, then I would say maybe even address it up front and just state that and state, I know that for some people this is stigmatized, but this helps other people in the audience, and so this is what we're going to do. That said, because it is so highly stigmatized, which is weird to me that people have such strong feelings about fonts, but we really, really do. Because it is stigmatized, I would say just any kind of legible, sufficiently large sans serif font should be okay for most purposes.
Okay. And any comments on whether or not it should be dark font on light background versus light font on dark
Ooh.
Background?
Yeah, this has been a new question lately, so I've been getting this more and more. In part, I see people arguing about this on social media where they talk about Twitter night mode, for instance, versus day. I don't have much that I can say there, except for, again, if you know that there's a specific reason for your audience, then, you can make a change. The standard is still dark font on a white background, but, that's a standard that we inherited from trying to be like paper, right? So I'm not sure if you have a compelling reason to change from it, I would say go for it. But again, for all these things where you diverge from what people expect, I would say it's worth addressing it up front. And that's a key point that I think is worth really hammering home. There's certain things that people expect when they go to a presentation of any variety. So if it's a PowerPoint presentation, people are expecting, they're expecting certain kinds of fonts, not others. They're expecting certain kinds of backgrounds, not others. But there may not necessarily be a specific reason for that, or it may be a historical reason. Like I said, we want it to look like, typed writing on paper. So if you have a compelling reason to move away from that, recognize that people will have these expectations, whether they're conscious of them or not. And then if you can make them conscious of it and say, I intentionally chose to do this for these reasons, then it should be fine. And I'll give you another example. So for my dissertation, I have a ton of maps, and it's heat maps of hot and cold patterns across the country for different pronunciations. And normally, people will do those with a scale that goes from red to white in the middle to blue on the other end of the spectrum. But there's red-blue colorblind people as well who are going to be in the audience as I defend the dissertation. So I have chosen to go with a colorblind-friendly palette. It's a totally different color scale, so it goes from like purple through green through yellow for hotspots. And when I first sent that off to some of my dissertation advisors, they said, well, why does this look this way, and you should change this to look like the standard red, white, blue. But with the explanation, rather, that this was done for a particular reason for accessibility, they were fine with it. And I think most people are going to be that way. So if you have a specific reason for, a dark background, then go for it. Just so long as it's not, dark writing on a dark background in a Comic Sans because you think it's fun, you want to make sure that you're actually making changes that make it more accessible to people rather than less so out of personal preferences. So I guess the key thing is you want to stay away from that, 1990s GeoCities personal web page look of, magenta writing on a yellow background or something. I don't know the ages of the audience here, but I'm assuming some of you remember the 90s and the early days of the Internet.
And, again, with cat memes. I think
okay.
we're seeing more
okay.
comments about adding those memes.
I got a bad feeling that's going to be the one takeaway for this is OSU presentations will all involve cats for some years to come, which means that I did not do my job correctly. So use sparingly, use judiciously. All right, so let's continue to platform skills. I am going to get you out of here on time, so I'm keeping an eye on all this. So for platform skills, I've divided this into 6 points for a variety of reasons. We can divide it into more or fewer, But six is a really good number of bullet points for a slide, as I mentioned earlier. So we're at six here. And what I'll say is we'll go through each of these, but their prior preparation, your posture and movement, your breathing, your speed and pacing, and then we'll talk about asking and answering questions. So this is, you know, how you physically move in the space and how you talk as you're going about giving a presentation. So for your prior preparation, first thing, is there a preferred format? In this case, yes, there is. So for, you know, NARPM Presents, for OSC Academy, for all this stuff, there is a very specific preferred format, and I am following that format. Now, you may not like the format, depending on what it is, but in general, if an organization has a format, they tend not to be the worst thing ever. So it's, you know, this is no more than six bullet points, so divided across multiple slides, no more than one secondary level of bullet points. The bullet points should be this kind of bullet point, not that kind of bullet point. The font should be this and not that. The font size should be this and not that. That indicates to me that somebody somewhere in the organization gave some thought to these presentation skills, and also gave some thought to making sure that the organization represents itself in a consistent way across platforms. And that's generally a good thing. Even if maybe I want, you know, three levels of bullet points, or I prefer to have dots instead of diamonds, or whatever it may be. So, you know, some of those things may be mildly annoying. Maybe you don't like the color scheme, but you have a preferred format, use it. If you don't have a preferred format, then you want to follow some of these best practices, which again would be, you know, no more than six bullet points, keep it short and sweet, trying to have level after level after level of sub-bullet points. And if you're going to have images, you know, have them on another slide or have them on one side of the slide, and preferably something that's directly related to what you're talking about. The second point here is, what is your time frame for providing secondary materials? So these slides, because I've given this presentation before, I had them well in advance. I think we had them a month out of the first presentation. So you know, your time frame will vary. For some, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, so for this talk that I gave earlier in the week, I brought my own computer, my own slides. So, you know, theoretically, I could have been putting finishing touches on them 5 minutes before, which I don't recommend. But, you know, it was a possibility. In other instances, you have a time frame where it's like, we need your slides 2 weeks in advance. So, you know what those deadlines are, and be prepared. And the same goes for whatever it is. So if it's a poster, you'll need to know where you're getting it printed, you know, how you're transporting it, what your time frame is for that. All right. The next part for prior preparation is to decide if you want or need a script. And this is something where people really vary. So I hate writing a script and rehearsing it. I absolutely detest it. I think it's just the worst thing for me. But I have colleagues who absolutely hate not having a script. And they will sit down, and if they're given a six-hour talk, they will, you know, six-hour full-day session, 3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, they will sit down and write out the full 6 hours and practice it. And they feel better for doing it that way. And they can diverge, obviously. They can adapt. But they know exactly what they're going to say, where and when. So whatever your preference is, you know, do what works for you, but recognize that there are different preferences that people may have, and so it's up to you to decide if you want or need that script. Then practice. You decide if you need to time yourself. What I will say is that nobody likes going overtime. So I've never had a talk where, well, I haven't given a talk that's gone overtime in quite a while, but in the past few times that I have, years and years ago, I got to tell you, nobody said, we really were so glad that you took the extra 15 minutes. It's just not something that happens. So make sure that you understand what the format is going to be. If there's going to be, for instance, a question and answer period that you need to leave time for, if there's going to be, you know, a moderator who's introducing you and closing out the event, you want to make sure that you leave time for those in your prior planning. And if you need to time yourself to make sure that you can stay within the parameters that you have, then time yourself. The last part is brainstorm possible questions. So don't focus only on the smart questions that you would either like to be asked or you hope somebody doesn't ask. You want to ask yourself, how might people not get it? And be prepared for that. Because what I'll say is, yes, it's good to think about what are the hard questions that I might get, and how is somebody going to challenge what I'm saying. Be prepared for that. But I think most of you don't need to be told that. That's when we give a presentation, that's our worry, that somebody's going to ask us some hard question. So we usually have some answer prepared for them. The stuff that's a little bit more difficult in some ways is the stuff that catches you just completely off guard, where somebody asks you a question that's just totally out of left field, and you have to, you know, think fast on your feet about how to answer that. And what I will say is the more that you can think about what kind of questions people will ask if they don't get it, where they can miss the point, the more you can, one, prepare people so that they understand as you're going through your talk. You've prepared it so that they understand what you're saying. But two, you can be ready for this kind of left field crazy question and either be able to answer it or be able to address it without getting completely flustered. And this happens to everybody. It happens all the time. And when it does happen, when you recognize, ah, this is that, you know, crazy left field question, then it's a lot easier to handle that and be calm and under fire there. So moving on from that to platform skills, what I'll say is that effective speakers will manage a variety of different components as you're managing your body in the space. Now, I have this divided across two slides, so I'm going to go back to the first one, and we're going to go through these. This is 7 points, and I think they're all very important. The first one is the most important point, which is we all get nervous before giving talks. Everybody does. But what I will tell you about this that's really interesting from the literature is that it's hard to really differentiate the physical response of nervousness and anxiety from excitement. There's a fantastic book out there called How Emotions Are Made, and one of the things they talk about is trying to localize emotions in the brain and in the body and physical responses. And the key takeaway from this book is that it's really not possible to say this is the biological, physiological signature of anger, and this is the one of excitement, and this is the one of fear, and this is the one of this, and this is the one of that. Instead, they're all implicated across a variety of systems with the autonomic nervous system, with the brain, with all this stuff that's going on. And the physiological signature of excitement, as you're looking forward to doing something that you want to do, if the more excited you are about it, the more indistinguishable that is from nervousness. So it's possible to transform the way that you look at it. You transform nerves into positive energy. And also recognize everybody gets nervous before a talk. It doesn't matter how long you've been doing this. So as you're getting ready, at least for me, it helps to say, okay, this is normal. This is nerves. You know, maybe my hand's shaking a little bit. That'll go away. This is to be expected. Used to this, everybody does this, it's fine, and let me reframe this as excitement. The second one here is voice, so volume, pace, and intonation. Volume, you'll want to calibrate to the room if you have a microphone, that makes it easier for you. Pace and intonation are the other two. For me, pace is an issue, so I always have to remind myself, slow down. And one of my mentors who taught me facilitation techniques always, always, always used to tell me to think of Maya Angelou. So I don't know how many of you have seen television interviews or heard radio interviews with Maya Angelou, but she savors every word that she says. And it's weirdly engrossing. It's very, very engaging. So she's not just talking slowly. It's not dull in that way. Rather, she's really taking time to think about what she wants to say, how she wants to say it. And she's saying it in a very clear, very, not over-enunciated way, but she's very clearly articulating her words and choosing them carefully. I'm not saying that emulating Maya Angelou exactly is what everybody should be doing, but for those of you who are like me who go too fast, it's something worth reminding yourself periodically as you're talking. And that last one is intonation. So intonation is, again, the rise and fall of your voice. If you speak in a monotone, because, for instance, you're reading your slide, it becomes very, very, very boring for people very, very fast. The more that you can make it like either a conversation, you know, an animated conversation with friends, or even think about an animated conversation on stage in theater, the better it is for your audience, because you're doing things that directly relate to getting sort of an emotional response from people. You're not just standing there saying, okay, effective speakers will manage nerves, transformation into positive energy, voice, volume, pace, intonation. You're not reading your slides at people. Instead, you're communicating, really communicating with them. Third on this is eye contact. That's range and focus. There's a classic joke about I heard it about engineers, but I think it actually is really applicable to academic linguists as well, which is how do you tell the outgoing engineer or academic linguist? And the answer is they're the one who are staring at your shoes when they're talking to you rather than staring at their own. I'm pausing for laughter. Okay. The point of that is eye contact really does affect how we're perceived. And that varies by culture, that varies by geography, that varies by place, but in general, as you're giving a presentation, the expectation is that you're looking at your audience. This does not mean that you're making, you know, hard eye contact with every person, moving from person to person, just, you know, mad-dogging them in the middle of a presentation. I strongly recommend against that. Also, it doesn't mean that you pick one person and make direct eye contact with them for the whole presentation, because, again, that's going to make them feel very uncomfortable. It's going to make everybody else feel very uncomfortable, because they'll notice, why is this presenter just staring at that one person? So in general, the idea is that you'll have sort of a diffuse range, diffuse focus, but you're looking at your audience. And you'll notice if you watch stand-up comedians, for instance, they look like they're talking to their audience. For the most part, on stage with spotlights and everything, they can't see their audience. But what they're not doing is, you know, looking down, staring off at the wall, staring off in weird directions. They're looking out in the general direction of their audience. They're scanning the room. And that's fine. That works very well. And it gives the feeling of eye contact, even if you're not making direct eye contact as you're scanning across the room from person to person. So, you know, within the context of giving a presentation, eye contact is generally expected. In other cultural situations, eye contact may be expected by some people. So, for instance, northern sort of Anglo and Germanic European people and, you know, white folks from that background in North America tend to expect eye contact as a sign of trustworthiness and whatever else. There are other backgrounds where people expect a avoidance of eye contact as a sign of respect. So those are things to be aware of as you're interacting with people just in your day-to-day life. But for presentations, look at the audience. General best practice, unless you have a specific reason not to or have been told not to for some reason. The last on this slide is body. So that's posture, stance, and movement. And those are those cues that we talked about at the very beginning, where people can read off of your posture and your stance your confidence. The thing about confidence and body posture is this is one of those fake it until you make it situations where there's a ton of empirical evidence that, one, people perceive you to be confident if you stand in a confident way, and two, standing in a confident way and being perceived as being confident boosts confidence. So what that means for our purposes is not pacing and rocking and swaying, so swaying from one foot into the other and one foot to the other, but something akin to a power stance. It doesn't have to be like a real Superman stance. That's going too far with the hands on the hip and the feet spread wide. But feet, you know, shoulder width apart-ish, whatever's comfortable for you, and stand upright, you know, stand tall, and you'll want to do that anyway to look out at your audience without having to crane your neck. So those alone go a long way towards giving people the perception of confidence and to creating confidence in what you're saying. And it's fairly straightforward. I think a lot of times we get hung up and start overthinking what we're doing. You go, what am I doing with my body? What am I, you know, how am I moving in the room? What am I doing with my hands, which I'll talk about next? And we overthink it. And so what I would say is you can't go wrong with just planting your feet, facing the audience, standing upright, you know, chin up, eyes forward, and talking to them. And yes, you can move around. Yes, you can look at your slides. Yes, you can look at your notes if you have them. But the idea is that you keep returning back to this headquarters of I'm standing tall, feet a normal width apart, and, you know, talking to the audience. All right, so we should be on the second slide here for platform skills. That's gestures, language, and transitions and segues. For gestures, this is building on the body. Hand and facial gestures, don't overthink it. Especially if you're nervous about presentations, we all have the tendency to overthink our gestures and our facial expressions. And then you get into this vicious cycle of overthinking. Did I just make a face? Did I just make a face thinking about making the face? Are they noticing the faces that I'm making? Are they judging my faces? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Same with the hands. And I'm sure you've all seen presenters who, you know, don't know what to do with their hands. And the hands go in the pockets and come out of the pockets, go behind the back, come in the front, they cross their arms. You can do whatever's comfortable for you. But if you start thinking about, oh my God, what do I do with my hands? What I will tell you is, one, if you have a microphone, that gets rid of one hand right there. It's easy. Just hold the microphone. And two, and this is the hardest thing to remember, I have to consciously remind myself still, you don't have to do anything with your hands. So I gave a presentation, it was a co-facilitated presentation to a very large audience the other day. And when my co-facilitator was talking, I'm standing at the front of the room, and I'm not gesturing because I'm not talking, and I'm just standing there. And I remember thinking, oh God, what do I do with my hands? And then reminding myself, you don't have to do anything with your hands. So if you're standing in front of the room, you're not talking because somebody else is talking, or even you are talking because you're giving a presentation, you can literally stand with your hands at your side, not in your pockets, not doing anything, and nobody will notice and nobody will care. They may feel leaden and heavy and weird, but that's that's entirely something going on in our own minds as we're giving presentations. And so that's a huge, huge thing that I think people really overthink, and you start to see people overthink, and then it gets kind of distracting. So if you don't know what to do with your hands, don't do anything with them. Very, very easy. For facial gesture, facial expressions, I would say you want to be mindful of how they can come across. So especially if you have unexpected questions, for instance, I grew up in a background where some of you may be familiar with this, some of you might not, but one of the things that kids are sometimes told, especially when they're misbehaving, when they're crying, when they're reacting in ways they shouldn't, is fix your face. And what I will say is that's very, very good advice to remind yourself when you are giving a presentation. It's just you don't really have to be doing anything, but especially if people ask you these unexpected questions, for instance, keeping that neutral face, nodding along to indicate that, yes, I am listening to your question. Those are very, very, you can't go wrong with those, I guess is what I want to say. With other stuff, you know, expressions of anger and confusion or whatever else, I mean, maybe you feel it, but to the extent that you can keep that to yourself as you're giving a presentation, it's going to go a lot smoother. The last part is I come from a background where we gesture with our hands. Some of you do, some of you don't. If you are from a background where you gesture a lot when talking, so the extreme example of this is like Southern Italian background. For some people, it may be distracting. So what I would say is, to the extent that you can, make sure that your gestures are fairly straightforward and related to what it is you're saying. None of you can see me right now, but I'm actually gesturing with my other hand that's not holding the phone as I'm doing this. But it should be related to what it is you're saying. So obviously obscene gestures should be avoided, including gestures that may be fine in your cultural background but are not fine everywhere. So, you know, it's worth knowing what those are. If you're not sure, maybe don't make that gesture. But in general, it's very, very easy. You can't go wrong with just a relatively neutral face, hand gestures that are related to what you're saying, and if you don't know what to do with your hands, you can just do nothing with them and it's fine. Moving on to language, you want it to be inclusive and technical. And what I mean by that is some of you, many of you will have jargon that's related to your jobs. That jargon needs to be explained. The best practice for this in general, even with people who understand it already, is to say what you're going to say, explain it, and then continue, maybe even repeat. So I do this all the time. I was just teaching an undergraduate class, and I know they had learned certain things about the International Phonetic Alphabet, but even that, you know, even talking about phonology, which is how sounds are processed in the brain, and phonetics, which is how we actually realize them out in the world, that's exactly how I explained it. I didn't just say we're doing phonology and phonetics. I said phonology, which is how sounds are processed in the brain, and phonetics, which is how they're realized out in the world, you know, as sound waves. And then you keep it moving. So your examples are going to be very different from what mine are here, but it's always, always, always best to do that, and even more so if it's an acronym. So when you say OSC or NARPM or whatever, you know, even those, it's best to explain to people. And the worst offender with this is the military. The second worst is all the rest of the government, because it's very, very easy for us to forget that not everybody's in the same job position or the same background or has the same jargon or the same skills. And so, you know, working with the military, for instance, we'll go around the room and introduce ourselves, and people will say, I'm so-and-so from thus and such, and I'm at Spaywar Syscom, and I do HD2 and, you know, CRW, and nobody else knows what they're talking about. So even within the same organization. So I would say best practice, make it inclusive. If it's technical, if it has to be technical, make sure that you just explain as you're going along. And that keeps everybody on the same page. And what I'll tell you is for the people who already know the jargon, they're still grateful for that as well. It's just translating the jargon into everyday speech. It's a very, very good skill to have. Lastly, transitions and segues. You may have noticed that what I did from the beginning is say, this is the organization of the course. This is what we're going to do. I give my introduction. Then I said, what questions do you have? And I said, that was the introduction. Now we are going to move into talking about this. So every time that you move from a key chunk of your presentation, from a one piece to another, give people that signpost. And that signpost is cumulative. So then the next step is, well, we did this, and then we did this, and now we're here, and next we're going there. If it's a long talk, if you have like breaks in the middle, for instance, a 10-minute break for the bathroom, then you're going to try and fit that at a good place, although, you know, listen to what the audience needs. And same thing, we did this, we're here, we're going there. So I normally I'd ask, does that make sense? But I'm going to continue along. If you have questions, please don't hesitate to shout them out. And actually, I'm on to questions right now. So let me do questions here, and then we'll take further questions after this. In soliciting questions, you may have noticed I did not ask the way that we're used to hearing. I didn't say any questions. Does anybody have any questions? Instead, each time, I have assumed that there would be questions, and I've asked, what questions do you have about this? I think at the very, very beginning is the only time I ask, are there any questions? Because usually, if I've spoken for 2 minutes and I've said, hi, my name is Taylor Jones and I do this, there aren't any questions. I want to make sure, you know, if there are, that I can address them. But beyond that, once we've gotten into our subject matter, assume that there are questions and license people to ask those questions. So it's best to ask, what questions do you have, or some version of that. When you ask what questions do you have, it gives people that license to have a question and to ask. And then after you ask for questions, stop talking. Wait several moments for them to think, because if you don't stop talking, they won't ask you their questions. And it's a perfect time to take a drink of water, a sip of coffee, whatever it is you have. That's something, if you need something to do. If you don't have a drink of water, just count in your mind to 10 before moving on. And I guarantee you, 9 times out of 10, if you are counting quietly in your mind to 10, you know, 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, before you get to 10, there's going to be a question. And if not, maybe you're doing a great job and nobody has questions. Maybe they don't feel comfortable asking them right now, whatever, but you've done your part. You've given them the time that they can actually formulate a question and ask it. I had a colleague who got flustered at an event and said, you know, all right, so we're here. They're at the key turning point, the segue, and said, we're here. We did this. We're going to do this. Are there any questions? If you don't have any questions, I'm going to continue, but I'm going to leave time for questions. Do you have questions? Are there no questions? I don't see any hands going up. I think there's no questions. Okay, I'm going to go. Didn't give them the opportunity to breathe and to think. And so it turned out later on we found out there were questions, but there was no moment for people to ask those questions. So before we move on to answering questions, what questions do you have about any of what we've discussed before?
There was a question that came in about what people should do when they're moving through slides on a laptop but they don't have a remote.
Yeah, that's less fun. the remote is definitely ideal. Yeah, that's tricky. What I will say is it does give you something to do. I think people understand if you have to, you know, pull slides on your laptop. I'm assuming this is being projected. If it's just on a laptop and you're, you know, around a conference table or something, that's a little bit different. But if it's being projected and you have to then go to the laptop to press it, one, it's ideal if that is in a place where you can be seen. I actually just did this earlier in the week, and the laptop was off in a corner. And so what I ended up doing was I would know, sorry, I would know as I was getting close to the end of the slide and needed to go to the next slide, and I would just leisurely, slowly walk over to the corner of the room, hit the slide button, and then come back to where everybody could see me. And so on the one hand, it does actually give you something to do physically that makes it gives you less to have to worry about or think about or manage in terms of your body, because I got to walk over there and then I got to walk back over here. But the key is, remember, got to walk back over here where I can actually be seen and where I'm in a good place for the presentation, rather than now I'm hunched over hiding in the corner talking to my slides because the physical space made it that way. And I think that's the key temptation, right, that we have is I got to stand right by the laptop so I can mess with the slides. The other thing that I'll say is people recognize that that's the situation, and so they will let you have that second of downtime to walk over to the slides. If you've finished and you got to go change the slide, people are generally pretty understanding about that. So hopefully that answers your question, but it's definitely ideal to have that remote, but we don't always have the ideal situation. So to the extent that you can just remember to go back and talk in front of the audience and manage walking back and forth between the slides, that's the best way that you can handle that.
Okay. And how about thoughts about handouts versus giving the audience copies of your slides?
That is something that I would say really depends on the audience and the expectations. So I am a sociolinguist. I do a lot of research around, quantitative study of how language change is related to culture, region, race, ethnicity, gender, all that stuff. Sociolinguists tend to have slides and lots of graphs and graphics in our slides. I gave a talk on syntax, which is the structure of language, like the grammatical structure of language in the mind. Notice I'm clarifying that jargon as I use it. And this was something where I was talking about morphosyntax in Zulu, and syntacticians have a completely different expectation around what's going on. So most of them don't use slides at all. They tend to have some sort of like bullet-pointed essay or paper that they'll hand out, and they'll do handouts there. So that's something where the reason I mentioned that is that it really depends on the audience and the expectations. A third one is the military. They generally really want to have your slides on a piece of paper with an extra section to take notes on one side. So if you know what the expectations are for your audience, this is going to be a recurring theme. Do whatever those are. If you don't have any expectations from your audience that, they haven't given you any clear expectations, then what I would say is I usually recommend having slides, no matter what. If you don't use them, you don't use them, that's fine, but it's better to have them than not. And then if you want to have handouts or handouts that complement your slides or handouts that are your slides, then so much the better. But the more that you can give people that is useful to them, the better it is. Anything else?
Okay. No, I think maybe we'll just move on in the interest of time.
Excellent. All right, so answering questions. Sometimes you get contentious people. So let me go back here. Sometimes you can let the audience answer for you. I think for a lot of you, you probably can't, but to the extent that the audience can answer for you, if there's somebody else in the audience who really wants to explain it to the person who asked the question, then you can absolutely do that. That's a good way of managing contentious questions in the audience as well. And then for participant management, you want to use participants' names where possible. So that's if you're in a situation where there's name tags or whatever, do that. Reinforce desired and appropriate behaviors. That just means if somebody is using inappropriate language or coming across a very aggressive and hostile and rude way, that you do not then you don't then sort of stoop to that level. I was about to say you don't wrestle with the pig, which is, never wrestle with the pig, because all that happens is you get muddy and the pig likes it. So for those of you who haven't heard that idiom, you're welcome. For those of you who have, just it's a good reminder. Reinforcing desired and appropriate participant behaviors is the equivalent of just don't wrestle with a pig. And then refer to previous contributions. made by the participants. So it's really, really helpful to then be able to tie back something that somebody, in your answer, for instance, to a question, to something that somebody else said in the session earlier. What I'll say too is effective speakers respond appropriately to questions. That is, either you answer the question, or if you can't answer the question, you say, "Yeah, I don't have an answer for you right now, but I can get back to you," assuming you actually can get back to the person. And then you manage challenging participant behavior. And the idea is that you want the experience to be enjoyable for everybody in the audience. And it's your job as the facilitator or the presenter to make that happen. Now, this doesn't mean that everybody's behavior is your responsibility, because it's not. But you are in charge, and you can ensure that people, or attempt to ensure that people behave in the appropriate way by modeling that behavior and then managing challenging participants. So, for contentious participants, there are a number of best practices here. One is attempt to take their questions in the best, most charitable light. Sometimes this is hard, but in general, try and take it in the best, most charitable light. That may mean that you know that you are intentionally misrepresenting how they actually asked the question. Right? There are some people who have a question, or more of a comment than a question, really, where it's clearly not intended to be constructive. Even then, reframe it and attempt to take their question in the best, most charitable light. Thank them for their contribution. Thank them for their feedback. If they're wrong, one of the ways that I really find is incredibly helpful to deal with this is thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you the chance to clarify. So I had somebody just absolutely livid with some research that I had done, co-authored research, and they did not quite understand the research methods. And they said, "Well, you did this, this, and this." And instead of saying, "Well, no, I didn't, you're wrong," what I ended up saying was, "Thank you for bringing that up. I think that's very important. I'd like the opportunity to clarify because I did not clearly explain in advance or previously what I had done. And I think it's really important. Your perspective is valid. If I had done those things, however, allow me the moment to clarify what we actually did." And this was actually talking to a room full of judges about our research on court reporters that was contentious research that was in the news recently. But it worked out very, very well. It's worked out very well for me in the past. In general, take what they're saying in the best possible light. Thank them for their feedback. Thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you to clarify. And then don't get stuck repeating or clarifying. So once you've clarified, if they don't get it, then say, "Well, thank you. Let's talk about this offline later. I appreciate your feedback. Let's make time for questions from other people," for instance. If their comment's not relevant, that's even a little bit easier. Just say thank them for participating and refocus, with the option of discussing more after the presentation. Where this gets tricky is when you have that one person who really wants to talk, and their talk is not relevant, and they just want to keep going and keep going and keep going. At a certain point, you're going to have to say, "Okay, thank you for that. Let's talk about this more offline. You are in charge of this, so the audience, if you do not cut this person off, they will just continue to go." So recognize that the rest of the audience is there. They're with you. And when you cut them off and say, "Thank you for that. Let's talk about this more later," they're going to help you do that. And the last thing that I want to do here is touch on feedback. But let me ask if there are participant, what questions you have about participant management before moving on to that.
There's actually just a lot of chuckling at your pig wrestling reference.
I started to say it, and I heard it coming out of my mouth, and I thought, I might need to explain this. But this is something that, normally I'd preface that with, "My mama always told me, never wrestle with a pig," which was way folksier than I anticipated being today. All right, so I hope that was useful as far as participant management. That stuff, it seems very simple. But I got to tell you, it has gotten me out of a lot of tight spots where people get really, really angry. But if you are, especially they'll come in, especially talking about diversity and inclusion, they may have preconceived notions about what it is they think you're trying to say. And if they don't really listen or pay attention, they may still have those wrong notions even after you've said something completely different. And, this kind of thing of saying, "Thank you for that. I hear what you're saying. Those are best practices. The other thing that I didn't mention is rephrasing the question. So make sure that you actually understand what somebody's question is. Oftentimes, I've seen people who say something that comes across as really contentious, and when you reframe it in the best possible light and say, it sounds like you're asking this, this is the question. One, everybody then in the audience can hear what the question is, and two, sometimes you find that they were having a hard time expressing what they were trying to say, and really were trying to ask you something else. So that also is a best practice. Make sure that as you have questions, as you're dealing with questions, you rephrase the question. I haven't been doing it here, in part because the questions are curated and I know you can all hear them. So, but what I will say is you can still also ask for more feedback, more clarification before answering the question. And if you can't answer the question, you can't answer it. You can tell people, you know, I don't have an answer for you right now, but we can talk about how to get an answer in the future. Moving on from that, I want to talk about the gift of feedback. This is not necessarily a specific, you know, presentation skill here, but I think it's important. This is something that we include in every lesson that we do with CulturePoint. Feedback is hugely, hugely, hugely important. And I don't mean good job, way to go. I mean constructive feedback that allows you to improve performance. We always talk about it as the gift of feedback. And, you know, sometimes maybe you don't want the gift. Sometimes you've had too many gifts recently. But in general, the idea is you want to try and treat feedback as a gift. It's given to be helpful. If you are giving feedback, it should be a gift and not, you know, I hated this, whatever. It should be specific rather than general. So not the talk was dumb, but I didn't like this particular thing on this particular slide, for instance, for these reasons. It should be focused on behavior, not on the person. So if you're giving feedback about this talk, you know, again, it's not helpful to say Mr. Jones was dumb, but it would be helpful to say, you know, he did X, Y, and Z that created these outcomes. It should be descriptive rather than evaluated. So again, you notice he did X, Y, and Z that created these outcomes rather than he did X, Y, and Z, which was awful. It should be concise. So, you know, make it clear, make it to the point, and then, you know, I think a lot of times when we're giving feedback, especially if it's negative feedback, we get caught up in talking about the negativity or talking about the emotion and wanting that to be heard. Once you have the key point across that's about behavior, that's focused, that's descriptive, it's easy to reduce that to something concise and actionable. And it should be well-timed and checked. And by those I mean that sometimes, one, you want to be sure that the feedback is useful and is valid. And two, you want to be sure that it's actually given at a time when it's effective. Now, you can't always choose when you get feedback, but you can choose when you give feedback, and it should be sometime. Don't just avoid it, but it should be timed. I mean, there's a sort of a meme that's going around lately that I've seen where it's people saying, you know, are you in a headspace where you can accept bad news? And it's, you know, being made fun of a little bit on social media right now. But the general idea behind that of, you know, giving feedback, giving bad news when it's in a situation where somebody can actually benefit from that is their heart is in the right place there. So I would say also remember that as you're getting feedback, that it's a gift. Even sometimes the gift is poorly wrapped. Sometimes the gift isn't what you wanted. But in general, it's always telling you something. And people will also really react quite well to treating feedback as a gift. When they give you feedback, even if it's not in the constructive in these ways, if you say, you know, thank you for that feedback, if you welcome the feedback, people will notice. And it's a very, very positive thing where you can improve your own performance as well. So what we've done today is go through, you know, I gave a quick introduction of who I am. We talked about the state of the research on presentations and the fact that there is a lot of research about it and that we can improve our performance, our presentation performance, and we can improve our skills with practice, and that it affects how people interpret your performance and your presentations. From there, we talked about a number of best practices, going from visual aids to technology to what you do with your body and your hands to participant management. And now we are wrapping up at the end. So what I would like to do is leave, I think I have about 12 minutes for questions, comments, and concerns. And then I'm going to, you know, answer whatever questions you have and you can all be on your way this afternoon. So what questions do you have? And you'll notice as we go through, this becomes more and more meta, right? As I start using, telling you the things that I'm saying and then saying them again. But what questions do you have?
Okay. We had a question that went back to contentious participants.
Mm-hmm.
And the attendee noted that they participate, or pardon me, they speak at public hearings, and that they're constantly told to just stay silent when the comments are really ugly. What are your thoughts?
It depends on how ugly. But if they're really ugly and there's nothing to salvage, there's nothing to take in the best possible light, then, you know, in the past what I've done is just say, well, it really depends. I mean, so depending on what your position is, if it's a public hearing, then I think the best you can do is say, you know, thank you for your comment and leave it at that, even if you're not really thankful for their comment. Oftentimes I'm, you know, the facilitator in the room and I'm in charge of the event in some respects, and so I can shut that down as need be. But if you don't have the power to say that's not an acceptable way to be speaking in this room right now, either reframe that in a way where you have specific actionable feedback, because we talk about feedback, right? Or, you know, we can discuss this offline later, but, you know, I think my understanding is that in some public hearings you get people who just want a name call, and that's not productive. And you can, depending on if you're running the room, you can tell people that's not productive and we're going to move on. Or if you aren't in a position to do that, then, yeah, either silence or thank you for your comment, and no comment on it beyond that is fine.
Okay.
It's uncomfortable either way.
What about practicing? Is there a specific way you might recommend people to practice in front of others or by themselves?
Yeah, so whatever is most comfortable for you. I know some of my colleagues really prefer to practice their talks with a small audience of people that they know and like. So if you have friends and family who can tolerate listening to your talks, or if you have colleagues who can make time for that, then that's very helpful for some people. Others prefer to practice in front of a mirror. Personally, I don't like that. But if you need to practice, which most of us do from time to time, I would say if you can get a group together, then do that. Sometimes it's a little contrived, right? You know, you're talking like you're talking to a large audience, but it's really, you know, your best friend in your kitchen. Then it's going to be a little bit different feel. But you can still get some useful feedback. You can still get some timing issues sorted out, and it can be worthwhile.
Okay. And in terms of technology, would you have a recommendation on particular presentation tools or platforms other than PowerPoint? They kind of feel like they're using the same outdated basic presentation tool.
I will tell you that I actually kind of love PowerPoint, and the reason I love PowerPoint is that in certain corners of academia, LaTeX is this shibboleth. The idea is that, like, you know, if you're a real academic, if you're real smart and real capable, then you use LaTeX. But that's a markdown language, effectively, where you have so much more work that you have to do in order to get the same kind of slide. And yes, you know, the kerning on the fonts looks amazing. But if you don't have to do something else, you know, it has made me really appreciate the simplicity of PowerPoint, just out of the box. And so I would say that, you know, there's different ways that people do things. Some people like those mind map kind of things where it, like, zooms out and moves around. And you know, if you have the time and the inclination and the encouragement from your organization to do something like that, then more power to you. For me, I tend to use LaTeX if I'm not using PowerPoint, and it does require a lot more coding time and a lot more debugging. For, you know, a very sleek-looking presentation, but, you know, it's really up to you how much time you want to spend on that beyond that sort of extracurricular, I guess. And LaTeX, if you are interested in that, if you are, you know, that kind of coding enthusiastic person, it's LaTeX, but for some reason pronounced LaTeX.
Okay. What about PowerPoint or any presentation template or tool? where you're only using pictures, you're not using any text. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I like that. I don't always get to do that, but I actually really do like that. If you have a picture that is directly related to what you're talking about and can work as a mnemonic for you, so you know that you're going to say all the important points, or maybe you have your note cards or whatever it is you need for your presentation, then that can be a really effective way of doing things, in part because humans are wired, like hardwired for visual memory. So when you have images like that, it gives people something to focus on, to latch onto, and to remember later. And I got to say, some presentations that I've been to recently, the main thing that I remember, you know, months on, is the image, but the image is a hook for what was discussed. So I highly recommend it if you can. But, you know, recognize what the audience is and what the expectations are.
Okay.
And not all cats, unless it's a presentation about cats.
I'll just chime in here. We did have a tip from one participant who mentioned that they practice when they're walking their dog for presentations.
That's excellent. Yeah, and if you walk places, if you have time, like practice when you're walking, when you're in the shower, whatever, like when you have something, it can be a really good way of doing things. And you have built-in timing, right? You know, if you walk the same route, you know it takes you 20 minutes, then you know either I covered all my material or I didn't.
I think we'll take just two more questions here before we close out, just short of our scheduled end time. This next question is about anxiety when you're presenting, and they're wondering if there are ways to diffuse anxiety when you're in front of a large audience.
I meant to mention this earlier, and I'm glad that somebody asked. So, you know, everybody tells you stuff like, imagine they're in their underwear or something like that. That has never been helpful for me. If anything, it's more stressful. But what I will say is focusing on your breathing, slowing down your speech, taking your time and reminding yourself that you are the expert, that you are in charge, and that they're here to listen to you. Not that they're going to be judging you, but, you know, think about what you're like when you're in an audience. There's a couple of things here. So one, breathing. People get themselves out of breath and then, you know, break out in hives and then, you know, panic and whatever. If you're taking quick, shallow breaths, then, you know, starting to hyperventilate, it's going to help you sort of spiral into panic. And so I would recommend against that. So just remind yourself to breathe. That's another thing that you can do with your hands. If you put them just sort of, you can rest your hands sort of on your abdomen and it'll remind you to take a deep breath, and people are not going to really think twice about it. The other thing that I'll say is when people in the audience look like they're not paying attention, that's not a judgment of you. And there's a variety of reasons why that could happen. So I actually had a talk months ago where there was a guy in the front row who looked like he was sleeping the whole time. And it was really disconcerting. I was like, this guy's bored. He's hating this talk. This is not going well. Like, I was starting to spin out in my mind. I kept my breathing. I kept my pace and intonation. I kept using all these best practices that I talked about. After the talk, the guy who I thought hated it and was checked out and was trying to sleep in the middle of the class invited me to come out and give a presentation at his command, which was actually an international trip that was a very cool, like, very positive thing. So you never know. And sometimes people are just resting their eyes. Sometimes, you know, they got to check their email or something. Sometimes it's, you know, a warm room after lunch and there's no windows, and you're going to have a different experience from the audience. But all those things, just recognize you're all in it together, and just getting your posture together, getting your breathing together goes a long way. And then also don't overthink what you're getting back from the rest of the audience.
Okay. And then we'll take this one last question here, and this is actually coming from the audience's perspective. If they're in the audience and they're trying to listen to a speaker, but they're coming off as rude and unprofessional, and that's the speaker coming off that
speaker.
Way, how could they, how can they help that speaker to become more professional or sort of bring them back to a professional space?
Oh, I wish I knew. I've been in that experience actually recently, and you just kind of, it's like seeing a train wreck happen, and you just kind of want to, like, You just want to help. What I will say is one of the things that you can do to help people not spin out, assuming that it's not like that they're rude and unprofessional, but if they're just starting to get, overly nervous, is exaggerate paying attention and nodding along. I got to tell you, some of the best audiences I've ever had, there are people who are, nodding along with your points as you say them. They're indicating that they're listening and that it's affirmative and positive, and that's a really best practice for an audience member. If they cross a line and start being rude to participants and audience members, that's not something that as an audience member you can necessarily help them with. And as uncomfortable as it is, without jumping in and shutting it down, you basically have to just watch, and it's rough. It's rough to do.
All right. Well, we have just a moment or so left. So, Taylor, are there any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before we close things out today?
Well, I want to thank you all for your time. And what I'll say is that all of this kind of boils down to just tools for keeping yourself calm and prior preparation, and then just a little bit of organization around your slides. But once you have all of that taken care of, it allows you a little bit more flexibility on the day of to ride out whatever is going to happen in the room, because you know your slides are taken care of, you know everything's organized, you know your material, and it helps you sort of manage that. So hopefully you got some good stuff out of this and some tools that you can use. And thank you again for your time.
Okay. With that, I'll go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. I'd like to echo Taylor's thanks for the live audience who joined us, but I also want to thank Taylor for taking time to share his expertise with us. For those of you who enjoyed today's webinar, if you'd like to, I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org or sign up for our monthly newsletter so that you can learn about additional training opportunities or find other resources related to cleaning up hazardous waste sites. We do send out the monthly newsletter Tech Direct on the first of each month, so again, I strongly encourage you to visit us and sign up to stay informed of these sessions. To look at a complete list of resources, including copies of the presentation material, I'll encourage you to go back to that seminar homepage that you would have used when checking in. Remember, that page is active from this point forward, and you'll find a copy of his slides there. If you're looking for contact information for our organizers or our presenters, they're also listed there, but you can also reach out to me directly. And then I would ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that we covered along with the tools and mechanisms that we used to host the session. I commonly get asked if people can get a certificate for joining us, and you can, and you'll only get one of those, though, if you fill out a feedback form. So please be sure when you're filling out that form to properly list your email address and then check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the whole thing. If you do those two things, as soon as you submit your feedback form, you should immediately have access to a certificate that you can either download or print out for your own records. We usually do email it as well. Sometimes it gets stuck in spam folders, so you might need to look there. But if you don't get it, you can also contact me by email, and we'll be happy to reissue it to you. For those of you who join together in a group, each one of you can fill out that feedback form on your own to get your own certificate, even if you didn't register individually. So I would ask whoever did sign up for the course, please copy that seminar feedback URL and share that with your colleagues so that they can share their thoughts with us and get their own certificates. And as noted at the start of today's broadcast, this session was recorded. You'll receive an email in approximately 1 week to let you know when that archive is available for on-demand playback. And so with that, again, thank you so very much for joining us, and we'll go ahead and